Hi, today is March 10th, 2019, and this is Mobile View Podcast 290. I'm Todd Agasawara, my good friend John Westfall, and happy Spring Forward Day, John. You okay over there?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, just, you know, a little minor whiplash, you know. One of my friends had posted that we really should do Spring Forward Friday at 4 o'clock instead of Sunday mornings, and I pointed out that that would be fine, except that there would then be a revolt on the Friday that you had to fall back.
at
5 o'clock.
Yeah, so. I used to hate. You know, I've in Hawaii we don't observe daylight savings. We're just on standard time all year round. But I've lived in, you know, a couple of places where I had to observe it, and it was just I was just messed up all day, you know, just waking up.
You were just not happy about it.
No. Now, I read somewhere that there's some thought going through that, you know, you guys will be on daylight savings all the time. What do you think about that?
That would actually, for where I'm located, that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I've always lived on sort of, I mean, technically I'm kind of right in the middle of my time zone right now, but I've always lived more toward the western ends of my time zones.
Got it.
And so it has always been a lot nicer to be on daylight savings time than not, except when I was in New York. New York, it was pretty indifferent. I would prefer it if given the choice.
Interesting. You know, I think, I'm not sure this is still true, but years ago when I went to visit China, I wondered, you know, what time zone it's in, right? And, it's China's, you know, plus whatever it is, 20-something, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I was shocked to learn the whole country is in one time zone.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a much wider, larger physical country than the U.S. I was, whether in the West Coast or the East Coast, it's, you know, whatever time it is in Beijing, which I thought was kind of interesting. Must be weird, you know, on extremes of that time zone. But there you go. All right. And let's see. I didn't put in my show notes, but I had something about the GPS epoch, but we can talk about that later, maybe, if I go find the reference. Today is also National Mario Day, as in Nintendo Mario Kart. So, you know, I can't say I was kind of not that generation, I think. My daughter played Mario Kart on her Nintendo DS or Game Boy or whatever it was back then. Were you a Mario Kart person?
My wife's family, so my console gaming history jumps from the Nintendo, the 8-bit NES, to the Xbox 360. I didn't own any of the consoles. I had the Game Boy when it came out, but I didn't have any of the TV consoles. So I had not really grown up with Mario Kart. However, my wife had, and then in 2008 we got a Wii.
Yeah.
And we played probably more Mario Kart on that thing than any other game we ever played on the Wii.
I heard it was fun on the Wii.
It really was, and I actually do have on my wish list a Nintendo Switch just to play Mario Kart on it. So,
does the Wii still exist?
The Wii does, and there's actually a homebrew community for it. The servers have been shut down, but there's actually alternative servers that you can connect to. So there's still a Wii community out there.
Okay, but the product itself is gone, right?
Yeah, the product itself is gone. But I have thought about getting the
Switch.
Switch just to be able to play Mario Kart. Really, it's about $350 for Mario Kart and the Switch. But
wow, that's expensive.
People really love their Switches, though. I've had a few friends that are just really into the Switch. So I've thought about it, and I've thought about, you know, even if I had a bunch of money that I, you know, was burning a hole in my pocket, getting one for my wife and I so we could have our own units and play Mario Kart against each other. But that would be a pricey thing to do.
And by the way, the reason why today, March 10th, is National Mario Kart Day is not because it observes, you know, a special day for the creator or for the company or even Mario himself, but because the way we do dates in the U.S., month, day, year, instead of like the rest of the world, day, month, year, MAR10 looks like Mario. So
yes,
there you go. There you go. Okay, so we may or may not have a guest come on board, but we'll just kind of move forward. We don't have a lot of topics, but I have a couple of things I'd like to talk about with John. I'm really interested in one topic in particular, but the short ones are this. So I just happened to see in Ars Technica, there's an article titled A Brief History of Wi-Fi Security Protocols, and read a little bit about WPA3. And the reason that's interesting is since I didn't know we had a WPA 3. I know about WPA 2. But WPA 3 was ratified last January, January 2018. And it has an interesting feature, an NFC for authentication, which works like this. So you go up to the Wi-Fi router, and you tap your NFC device, and it joins the network. No typing or anything, which you could say, well, that seems insecure. And I agree, even if anybody can go up to a Wi-Fi router and tap your router. But, you know, there must be some kind of way to slightly secure it. I don't know, like a four-digit passcode or something, so that, you know, to allow you to tap it.
It reminds me a lot of WPS. Oh? The idea that you could tap on the like the WPS button on a router, and then for like a couple of moments, any device could connect, and it would exchange information, all that. So, yeah. I've not really ever used that.
Yeah, I always disabled WPS because it seemed insecure. I think there's an option to disable it on your device, right? Like use it or not, mm-hmm. kind of thing. But interesting, you know, and WPA3 apparently, well, you know, why would it exist if it weren't slightly better, right? So it had some other more secure ways to do things, including this NFC for authentication, you know, basically tap your device on the thing. Of course, if you're like a lot of people, you probably hide your router somewhere out of the way and you don't even look at it. So you'd have to go tell your guests, okay, go down the hall, open the closet door. What? And tap your phone on it, right?
So in a very odd sort of twist, my router is right next to where your picture is on my screen. So I will take a picture of that and I'll put it on our show notes because my router is not hidden. Of course, my router is this very strange-looking spaceship Asus router. So, you know, it's cool enough that you gotta show that off.
So is this one of those things with six antennas and all that kind of stuff?
It only has four.
Only four, okay.
you know, I almost said he only has four. You know, they get very personified.
Of course.
They're quite strange looking.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll put a picture and you can see that you are right next to where my whole home network is located. So,
you know, that's a good topic for some podcast someday. You know how we personify our devices? I mean, a lot of people used to name their computers in the old days, which I thought was kind of odd. But now with, you know, intelligent assistants like the Echo and the Google Assistant and so forth, it not only makes sense, it's kind of demanded of you to think of them as a kind of a, maybe not a person, but a sub-person, or more even like a pet.
Yeah, they're a thing of some sort.
Yeah. Yeah. I just looked at a photo that John sent off to me.
Yeah, you are right there next to the router and the NAS and all the funny other random stuff that's over there and the UPS and many other things. You're in a very prominent location.
It's funny. You know, I have two unwrapped boxed routers. Let me rephrase it. Boxed combination router access points for the day when mine dies. And they're, I don't know how long. I bought them probably a couple of years ago. They're probably too old to take advantage of a lot of new stuff, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that, I don't really... It's interesting, because I do have a test router over here somewhere.
Yeah.
And if I show it to you, you'll probably crack up, because it is a historic, very famous router, in a sense.
The Linksys...
It is a Linksys 54, WRT-54G, which and it's actually one of the good revisions. It's a version 2.2. So it was before Linksys realized that they were a little too powerful and you could do a little too much with them. So I do have DDWRT running on this. And this was my primary router for a number of years. And I've just recently, it's now my test router. So if I need a little wireless or wired network for testing, it becomes that router. But it's my little trusty. I've gotten rid of other routers that are newer that could have become the backup router just because this one has such a long and storied history to it.
And writable firmware or rewritable firmware.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Linksys in a box.
It does not support
Linux in a box. N.
Yeah. It does not support N, so it does not get used that often in primary production anymore.
Yeah, I think that's what a 2.4 megahertz only.
Yep.
Device.
Just B and G.
Yeah. Wait, was G 2.4?
Yep.
I guess so, yeah.
Yep. Nothing was until N was the 5.
Oh, what's that sound?
Like I was a ratchet. Putting a little clamp
It is a ratchet.
On the on the power cord for the Linksys.
It sounded like Munchkin gunfire for a second.
Yes, Todd, that was exactly what it was. I have a Munchkin gang war over here, and they are getting rough. It's a scary world.
Okay, next topic before we get to the topic I'm looking forward to listening from John is, you know, Windows 10. There's something weird about Windows 10 and its updates, right? How many misfired updates has Microsoft had since launching Windows 10? I mean, like, lots. Lots and lots. Including, you know, deleting files and all kinds of bad stuff. So the most recent one, apparently, mostly affects gamers. There's a specific patch in Windows, and we'll put a link to it in PCGamer.com, that for Windows 10, that is killing game performance and apparently causing problems with mice. Yeah. And Microsoft apparently acknowledges the problem and says they'll fix it, but it isn't fixed yet. But it's just one problem after another with Windows Update. I think fortunately for us, our home, none of our, well, I won't speak for you, but I think it's also true for you. None of our daily drivers at home are Windows boxes.
Yes, that's true. I do have a Windows virtual machine
that
I run all the time on my network attached storage that I connect to over VNC, but it does not seem to be a problem. Plus, if it dies, I don't really lose that much data.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm really glad I switched away from Windows as my daily driver at home. At work, it's another question. You know, I have to use Windows because that's what we use. But at home, usually I'm on a Chromebook. And, of course, when I record these podcasts and a few other things, not much, I'll use a Mac. And I also have a problem with a Mac, too, because, you know, that awful keyboard on the new MacBooks, the MacBook Pros. I'm not sure what to do with this MacBook, you know, is no longer a viable device for various and sundry things.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that. I was actually at an Apple store yesterday.
Wow.
And, that's hard enough for me to get to. But I was at one down in the only Jackson store in Mississippi, which is in Ridgeland, Mississippi, just of Jackson. I was there yesterday, and I was looking at... I was actually looking at the MacBook Pros, because my MacBook Pro is one of the last that many people thought of as a good generation.
Yep.
It's the 2015, so it's got all of the different ports that you might want on.
Yep.
I was thinking, you know, I told my wife, I think I'm probably going to replace this 2021. That's probably my year to upgrade, because it'll be 6 years old at that time. It'll be 2 years out of AppleCare. I assume that's about the point that I'll be getting all the latest features on macOS updates and all those things. So I was just looking because I was curious about all the bad things I'd heard about it.
Right.
And, you know, I think I'd be better, but it's sure a slow road with the butterfly keyboard oddities and ports situation. I mean, it does have four USB-C ports. Hopefully by the time I do upgrade in 2021, USB-C will be even more ubiquitous than it is now.
Yeah.
I didn't tell you, I actually found a USB-C cable I never knew I had. About 3 weeks ago, I was looking through some stuff, and I went, wow, that's a USB-C cable. I thought my first one of those I bought just a few weeks ago, and I've had this one apparently for months sitting around somewhere. I don't know what it came with. But I'm not completely annoyed about the new versions of the MacBooks, but I do get where people are frustrated with them quite a bit.
Well, I believe for most people, the main problem is a butterfly keyboard, which, you know, you either say it's okay or you hate. There's very little in between that, you know, I don't really care. People either say, yeah, it's fine, or they just hate it. I have not even tried it, to be honest. You know, what am I running? I'm running a 2013 MacBook Air. So my MacBook Air is getting long in a tooth, too. It is 6 years old this summer, so pretty soon. And
my office computer is a 2011 MacBook Air, and it's working just fine.
Yeah, I have a 2010 MacBook Air that's it still works. It can't update past whatever version of macOS it's running, and its screen is looking what's the word I want to use, wavy. You know, like interference problems. So, you know, the screen or the cable or something is going bad. Although it still boots, it's still usable. Runs a little hot, I must say, but you know, sort of amazing. It still works. Here it is, what, 9 years later? It's pretty amazing. So I guess we need to figure this out. Yeah, I don't know what to do. The main problem, of course, is that, you know, I do all, the best way I found to record these podcasts is to use a product, I think it's from a company called Rogue Amoeba, called Audio Hijack. And, you know, it's a paid product. It's, you know, I paid for it many years ago, paid for updates since. And, you know, I've looked at the recording on Windows, but that's just kind of a non-starter from what I can tell. Well, plus you got to run Windows, so there's a problem too. on the other hand, I did find that, you know, one problem I've been trying to wrestle with that John's aware of and has tried to help me out with is I use a free product called Levelator to do the volume leveling. So when John and I speak, because we're using different microphones and different distances from the mic and all kinds of, you know, all kinds of variables, our volume levels are actually quite different. I think I'm a little louder because I'm using a hot mic that's about 6 inches, 8 inches from my face, and it picks up audio, you know, more loudly than I think the microphone John is using. So what that program, which is a free product, Levelator, evens out the volumes when we speak. So it sounds more like we would sound if you were sitting, you know, near us in across from us at a table or something. That product hasn't been supported since I think 2012. But it works fine. There's nothing, you know, but one of the problems is when the next version of macOS comes out and all apps need to be 64-bit, sounding like iOS, anybody? This will stop running. Yep. And since it's no longer supported, nobody's going to update it and, you know, rewrite it, recompile it. Actually, probably just recompile it. But it turns out Rogue Amoeba, the same company that I bought Audio Hijack from, has a product that does volume leveling. So I think I'm going to spend my $30 or whatever it costs and buy that pretty soon and test it out with John. John, you know, the other thing that I thought we should test one of these days is apparently the new version of Skype for the web can record by itself.
Hmm.
You know, you don't need an add-on product to record your conversations. I think it does video recordings and saves it as an MP4. So maybe we can try it when we get off this podcast. And just a quick test, I'll try to record something and save it as MP4 and see if I can just extract the audio out and use that as a podcast. So maybe we'll test that and then report back later. Let's see. All right. And now for the topic I really wanted to hear.
So I mentioned to Todd that today, so my wife and I and our friends and their kids and mm-hmm. our friends' parents, mm-hmm. so 6 adults and 2 children, mm-hmm. are going to Walt Disney World in May. Mm-hmm. And we are excited about this. My wife and I like Disney. We haven't been there since 2013. Mm-hmm. And we said when we went back, we kind of wanted to do the whole Disney experience in a sense that Disney has multiple moving parts. You've got the parks, and then you've got the resorts that you can stay at, and then you've got the dining that you can do. When we were there, we were just 2 adults, and we had 2 days, and we just did what we wanted to do, which was namely ride all the rides. So we didn't eat at any of the restaurants. We didn't stay on property. We stayed off property at a like $40 a night hotel that was very good in Kissimmee. It wasn't a bad hotel, but we were doing it as cheaply as possible.
Sure.
This time, since we're going with friends, we decided to kind of treat ourselves to actually staying on property and dining at the different restaurants. And I'm very interested as a geek to sort of see how the whole Disney technology ecosystem now works. To give a little bit of background, when my wife and I were there in 2013, they were just switching over to a much more internet-based back end in terms of scheduling ride availability. So at that time in 2013, they were switching over from what was the original FastPass system. This system was the one that if you ever went to a Disney park and you saw people running as soon as they got into the park and you thought, where are they going and mm-hmm. why are they going there so fast? It was to get to fast passes and to get these little tickets. And the way it would work would be that you, in theory, would walk up to one of these kiosks. You would hit a button and it would give you a little ticket. And the ticket would tell you, hey, you can come back at... I actually have a picture of one of the tickets. So it said fast return anytime between 7:05 p.m. and 8:05 p.m. So it gives you an hour, and then when you get back, you get to ride in a you get to go into a queue line that's considerably shorter than the general admission queue line. So it benefits you to do this. Well, this system got abused in a few ways. As I mentioned, people would sort of sprint. If you had a large party, you just sent a bunch of people off to various parts, and they would grab the fast passes for you, and then you could, kind of use them the rest of the day. So Disney, in order to make it a little bit more equitable and also to kind of update it, the fast pass system came out in the mid-90s, went to Fast Pass Plus, which is a system where you can reserve your fast passes through your smartphone or through the web. And when we were there, they had a few of the fast pass kiosks still set up, but they were installing the Fast Pass Plus kiosks. I actually put a note in our show notes or a picture there for Todd that is basically a little kiosk built in and themed into the queue ride for Small World at Magic Kingdom. That allows the cast member who's operating it to kind of see how many people are eligible for Fast Pass and to allow, kind of level out the lines and things like that. And I remember even asking one of the cast members at that ride, I said something about it, and he was telling me a little bit about it. And he said, oh, yeah, take a picture. You know, it's kind of cool. We're excited about it coming in. And, the next time you're here, you'll get to use it. And I thought, I didn't know when I'd be coming back, but I didn't think it was going to be a whole 6 years. So I am eventually going back and getting to try it out. So that's one element. Along with it means that you can also look at ride wait times through your smartphone. So if you're in the park and you're going, gee, where I just want to ride something, what's got no wait? Oh, gee, if I go, 500 feet that way, there's a ride with no wait. I could just go walk right on. So these are some things that I'm sort of looking forward to report back. But I'm curious if any of our ones of listeners have any
fives.
Suggestions. Fives, yes. We do it in multiples of fives. It makes it look bigger. Everyone knows that. So if anyone has any suggestions or anything they'd like me to specifically check out, I'll also be going on one of the behind-the-scenes tours. That's a half-day tour that I plan on reporting back anything cool from there. I don't think I'm allowed to take any pictures, but I can at least talk about anything neat that we might not know about.
Yeah, I think Ryan joined us. I hear sound.
Yes, I hear sound.
Hi.
Is that you, Ryan?
Yes, I know you're wrapping up, but at least I can say hi.
No. We're not wrapping. We were just kind of in the middle of stuff. I had more questions for John. But you know, since you're here, we can do it later. I know you've kind of got a tight schedule. So Ryan Ozawa has been a guest on this podcast before, so he's pretty familiar with it. But he has not been on at the same time as John, because I usually try to rustle up Ryan to see if he can come on when John is on one of his super secret missions.
I think we've had one podcast that we've been on together, yeah, so this is not completely new, but yes.
So Ryan is...
John is replacement Ryan and vice versa.
Yeah, so Ryan is my... Let's see, what's the word I want to use for him? Social media guru. He is the guy who gets me in trouble on social media by saying, you should try this Twitter thing. It might be a thing. This Facebook thing, it might be a thing. I go, yeah? Facebook? What kind of dumb name is that, Ryan? He says, oh, try it. So, anyway, so Ryan has another thing that I've never heard of. And when he speaks, you know, I listen. Because, like I said, he's gotten me motivated to try a number of things that has taken root in my life. So, what's up, Ryan? What's this thing you're excited about now that I should know about?
Well, the good news is the thing that I'm excited about now is not new, so I'm late to it as well.
Okay.
But I think that it is timely because we are definitely in the backlash to the backlash to the backlash of social media.
Oh, yeah.
So we've looped around a few times, but we are back in the position where people are beginning or continuing to question the wisdom of investing so much of our time, energy, and attention into privately held platforms whose business model requires engagement. And engagement can be anything from happiness to rage. Mm. And it turns out rage is much more profitable. So, yeah. So there have been constant efforts to build the anti-Facebook or the anti-Twitter. You know, basically alternatives to them. Path, the app, was a big one. It had a pretty good run, but of course, eventually they pulled the plug. People have talked about, what was it called? Diaspora?
Yep.
Diaspora?
Yep.
Right? Not dead, but mostly dead. But, yeah. You know, still there. I think now in the app age, there are attempts to do it as mobile apps. So there's one called Minds, M-I-N-D-S, trying to make it more of a blockchain tokeny. Let's just throw as many jargon words into it as we can. You know, you've got Gab, which is basically racist Twitter. But for the most part, these are alternatives that are trying to do what the major platforms do. They say we will gather enough eyeballs inside of our walled garden so that it becomes profitable to sell advertising to
them. Yeah.
And the problem with that is nobody is going to get 100 billion users like Facebook, and nobody's going to get 100 million users like Twitter.
Yeah.
So eventually these platforms die. So what I'm getting into, and what is I think the future of these platforms, is open source, federated, decentralized platform. So, you know, something that nobody owns, something that anybody can run, something that doesn't care if there are one person on your site or a million people on your site. Mm. And believe it or not, as idealistic as it sounds, these are sites that don't necessarily run on advertising. They might run on donations or subscriptions, but the vast majority of them run on passion and love.
Wasn't that kind of Diaspora's? I mean, wasn't that open source and all those other good things too?
Absolutely. So there's still Diaspora.
Yeah.
There are other platforms like GNU Social and Pleroma. And I'm drawing a blank, but there are Identica was another one. They were open source social platforms. But I think the thing that changed and the thing that I wanted to talk to you about is that when you hear say stuff like open source, decentralized, federated platforms that use XMLs and APIs and whatevers, your eyes start to glaze over and you're like, forget it. I mean, You'll always have that friend in your life who says that life is better when you build your own computer and you're running Linux.
Yeah.
And he says, all you need to do is get the thingy and the widget, and then you put it in the thing, and then you run this, and, you know, it's just like 13 steps, and you've got a computer. And, mm-hmm. you know, you think to yourself, well, great, I'm just going to the Mac store, thanks. So that's the problem that these platforms have faced. It's You hear about it, you want to check it out, and then you go there and they say, okay, what's your API key? And you're like, what the hell is an API key?
Yeah.
And they say, what's your database schema? I don't know what my database schema is.
I don't know what a schema is.
And it doesn't take you long before you're like, you know what, I'm sure this stuff is really cool, but it's for people that are not me.
Yeah.
So all of these platforms, Diaspora, I keep saying it wrong.
I don't know.
It's probably the one that got the furthest because it was a relatively straightforward looking platform, but deploying it and running it was not easy. And it just kind of had that Linux / you know, build your own car kind of feel to it. It's like, it sounds like a great hobby, but I don't got time for that. So what came out in 2016, and this is why I'm saying it's old and I'm new to it, was yet another one of these open source, decentralized, federated social platforms called Mastodon. And it is, in fact, named not for the extinct pachyderm, but for the rock band. But many people, when it came out, started comparing it to the extinct pachyderm because, well, frankly, all of these projects have come out with great hope and promise and have died.
Yeah.
Gone extinct. But the thing about Mastodon is that it has persisted. And it has survived, and it has seen steady growth since its birth. And the number one reason why I think it has found some purchase and success is that it is not that scary or intimidating to interact with. Hmm. You know, you go to some of these other sites, and you're like, all right, I'll create an account here. And it feels like you're signing up to join the NASA Space Shuttle Launch Program. The simple and straightforward answer about why Mastodon is accessible is the developer said, it's going to look like Twitter.
Hmm.
And if you can sort out how Twitter works, you can sort out how Mastodon. And that could be a plus or a minus. But the fact of the matter is the plumbing under it is all open source, API, XML, yada, yada. But the face of it is pretty straightforward.
Hmm. And how long has it been around, Ryan?
So he launched it in 2016.
Oh, okay. 3 years, more or less.
I think he's up to version 2.7 now. Yeah. That's the version I'm running. It basically looks the same as it did today as it did when it launched, just with various additional features. But now the user base across the universe of servers, Mastodon instances, as they're called, is well over 2 million people, which is not great if you were trying to run the next Facebook. In fact, that's way too small if you were going to try to run the next Facebook. But it's perfectly fine when you're not trying to make money that way.
Hmm. So are the instances self-contained universes, or do they, because they're federated, they interconnect, and you can see everything on all the servers, or Absolutely. Is it a combination?
It's a mix of those things. And the metaphor that everyone rightfully talks about for many parts of this conversation is email. So email is a federated service. Email is not an app or a company. You don't join email. It's a platform. It's a layer, but there are different front ends to it, which could be Yahoo Mail or Google Mail or Outlook Mail, your office mail, whatever. So that's great. So you've got an email address and you can email everybody at your company. But guess what? You can also email somebody at Gmail, at Yahoo Mail, at another company, because they all speak the same language.
Yeah.
So that's basically how Mastodon and these other social open social platforms work. They are self-contained. You might have a affinity or a loyalty or a brand love or maybe a thematic reason to be using the service you do. Like I use Gmail because I like Google, maybe. Not that that's why I use Gmail. But you have a reason for choosing a particular email platform, but you're not stuck with just that platform.
That's interesting you bring up email, because in the old days, email systems didn't talk to each other. And by that I mean the old UCP-based email did talk to, between entities. But I remember when GTE and Bell Atlantic were set to merge, they had separate email systems that didn't talk prior to the actual merger. And so the rumor I heard from reliable sources, as they say, is that the execs of the two companies were using Hotmail to talk to each other because their two email systems didn't talk to each other.
That doesn't surprise me. And certainly you had like CompuServe Mail and Prodigy Mail.
And for a long time, you couldn't talk to somebody outside of CompuServe. You could later, but it wasn't. Or you could do it through UCP, I think. It was some weird thing like that. But it wasn't. It was like you said.
7638241082@CompuServe.
Oh, you still remember yours? Yeah. I don't remember mine anymore. But you
I don't remember mine either.
You had to be a bit of a email mechanic to get things to talk to each other back then. You didn't go around driving email, as they say, if you weren't a techie back in the old days.
Right. Well, the good news is email is federated now, and so are these social platforms like Mastodon.
Hmm. And when did you discover Mastodon?
Probably, the weird thing is I signed up for everything.
You're right.
As you know, probably.
As I know, yep.
And turned out Mastodon was one of those things that I signed up for when it emerged and forgot that I signed up for it. And then I'm like, why can't I sign up? Oh, okay, I have an account. But that kind of gets at the heart of what confuses a lot of people about Mastodon, because there is not one Mastodon server.
Right.
So when someone goes, oh, I'm on Mastodon, that's like saying I'm on email. That does not help you find them, because they could be anywhere in the email universe. You need to know what instance they're on or what service they are. Are they Gmail or Yahoo, or are they on any of these 4,000 to 5,000 instances out there on the internet?
Hmm.
So with Mastodon, what happens if the instance that you sign up for goes away?
That happens. In fact, I came in around the time people were getting very nostalgic about a witch instance, because, witches, I guess they got to stick together, but one of the bigger witch instances went down, and they all scattered to the winds trying to find each other. So it is possible that happened. But, take a look at Path. I loved Path. I put all kinds of crap in pictures and posts into Path, but when Path goes down, there's no alternative Path. It's gone. The good news about the federated system is that you know, they're still working on ways to make it easier to import and export things. But the fact of the matter is, it's not like all of your content necessarily disappears forever, and it's not like you don't have 1,000 other alternatives to sign up for.
So I'm looking at a list of Mastodon hosts. I don't know if it's complete, but it's on the joinmastodon.org site.
Yep,
it looks like they're thematic. There's one for Meow, which I guess is for cats, and
there are several for cats.
Bitcoin hackers, and there's a bunch for cats. Cats are a big thing on Mastodon. So no Mastodon.
Well, they're a big thing on the internet. The entire
In general.
The entire internet is run by cats. We just don't know it yet.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen Captain Marvel,
we're going to see it for the. I'm going to see it for the second time today.
Okay, well, no spoilers.
There is good
evidence
in that film to show you that cats are in fact rulers of the supreme universe.
I was going to say my daughter and I decided that Goose the cat is the best character in the movie, and it's a good movie. We're not saying it's a bad movie. We enjoyed it, but Goose the cat is special. I'm just saying. So do you join by thematic? It looks like you join by thematic choices.
So there are a lot of general instances. And, of course, the largest instances are general instances because that's sort of where you end up when you can't make up your mind.
Yeah, which would be me.
Mastodon.social is run by Eugene Roshko. He's the lead developer, so he runs his own instance. That is the biggest English-speaking Mastodon instance. But he just shut down signups. Because there has been criticism in the academic ivory tower analysis of federated open social platforms that if you allow what we would call main instances or, you know, centralized instances to exist, you're kind of defeating the purpose of federation.
Hmm.
It turns out that everybody wants to be on Mastodon Social, then you're not really helping it. So he shut down that so that when you're looking to sign up, you get to that page you're looking at that tells you sign up somewhere else.
Weird. Okay, so I'm in the sign up page. I'm looking at it says I speak, and so I'm going to choose. There's no Klingon, so I'm going to go with English. But there's a whole bunch of languages I don't even recognize.
Yep.
But at any rate, I'm going to choose English. And I speak English. Great. And then it says I am an artist, a musician, a writer. And a whole bunch of other things. Sports fan, gamer, sysadmin. Interesting.
So there are, as I mentioned, there are thousands of these instances. So the site you're on is trying to help you pick one.
I see.
I personally feel that, you know, it's sort of like wanting to start a blog and you actually spend 10 months trying to come up with the name of the blog rather than just blogging. Just sign up somewhere and start. And you will find very quickly, like, this is my neighborhood, great folks. Or, like, I do not belong here, I'm going somewhere else.
Oh.
You know, don't invest too much energy into it because you can go somewhere else anytime. You're not locked into that instance. In fact, I have accounts on about 8 instances as I shopped around and said, okay, these people are too smart for me, and found somewhere else to go.
I see. So you can lurk before you become active, I guess.
Absolutely. You can just read. So, I mean, for your podcast, Mastodon.technology, run by a guy named Ash Furrow, might be a good place to start because basically he says, my instance is for nerdy people, techie people. So Mastodon Technology is, in fact, where I lived prior to launching my own instance.
Oh. Mastodon. I'm sorry, what was it? Mastodon.
Technology?
Oh, that's easy. Okay. All right.
And if you're an artist, you would go to Mastodon.art.
That's funny, you know, because I just said I am an artist just because that was the first thing on the list. And I don't see Mastodon.art. I see Viz Social, which is kind of interesting. Social space. Data visualization. So I thought that was kind of cool, but I don't see Mastodon.art in this list.
It might be closed.
Might be closed.
So, so they
open
and close their doors. Or they just want to kind of moderate that influx, right? So what happens is, what I've observed is that most instances are open, and then suddenly Mark Zuckerberg does something incredibly stupid, and then hundreds of thousands of people suddenly decide they want to get into Mastodon, and they just flood all the gates.
Yeah.
So they start to close the doors again. And then people calm down, nobody's mad at Mark Zuckerberg anymore, and they open up the door, and then Twitter guy does something stupid. He fails to shut down a Nazi. Next thing you know, everyone's signing up for Mastodon again.
So it's a very reactive population.
Well, you know, I think even the instance I'm running, I have I have an application process. I'm looking for a certain type of person. Yeah. And so if you're not that type of person, then you can probably find another instance. The really good thing about Mastodon is you can be as picky or as indiscriminate as you want.
What does it take to run Mastodon? Do you need, can you just, have a virtual server somewhere and install it? Or
Yeah. If you're comfortable with packages and things like that, it's relatively straightforward to install.
Yeah.
And the good news is that there's already managed service providers that can install it for you automatically, just like you can find a web host that will install WordPress on that. After I tried to install it once and failed, I just went to one of these companies called Masto.host and just said, make me an instance. And that was it. I have an instance. It's ready to go. In fact, there are very many. When I say there are thousands and thousands of instances, if you chart them on a graph, there's a big spike on the left where the big instances are, like Mastodon.social, the ones that people are now saying are too big for their own good. And then there's kind of a big spike at the far right because there are many, many, many instances for one person. There are many, many, many instances for a couple. Because the other thing that people like, especially if you're into free and open source software and the ethos that goes with that, is owning and controlling your own destiny. So in fact, why would I join Gmail or Yahoo Mail or Hotmail? Why can't I just be Taro Gasawara Mail? And that's effectively what they're doing with their own instance. So you, as Todd, could start Mastodon.com. And the only person on Mastodon.com is you. But you can still federate. You can still follow your favorite cat people on Tube.cat. You can still follow your favorite artists on Mastodon.art. You can follow me at masthead.social. It's completely the same experience, even though you're by yourself on your server.
Oh, in fact, there's a science fiction author whose books I've read that I'm reading a Wikipedia page now that has a Mastodon instance. I don't know how to pronounce his name. John Scalzi. You may have read some of his books. He's done some pretty interesting books.
John Scalzi, I know him.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, back in 2000, I put on an event for online journalers called JournalCon.
Yeah.
And he was, at that point, not a published author. He was published in the sense that he wrote about his life on the internet, which was novel at the time. But guess what? It turned out he was a novelist.
Quite a good one, it turns out. I've read a couple of his books. I think Will Wheaton reads his stuff on Audible often. Not
Will Wheaton had a negative experience with Mastodon.
Oh.
If you built a timeline of all of the pivotal moments in Mastodon's evolution, Will Wheaton would be his own dot, that's for sure.
I'm trying to read... Say that again?
I'm sure you can imagine that when a celebrity gets onto a new platform,
it's
pretty disruptive to the entire universe.
Yeah.
I mean, to the entire universe. So to say that he was disruptive in the Mastodon universe was an understatement. And whether or not these are normally nice people, a number of them were not happy about it. And they let him know. So he felt himself driven off of Mastodon, which is sad because, eventually I'm hoping there is one celebrity who has the right following, who understands how this all works and, can bring the masses into the Mastodon universe. But there are a lot of people in the Mastodon universe that say, stay the hell out. We don't want muggles in here at all.
And I was just reading a bit about Mastodon. So it's based on, the server side is based on Ruby on Rails and Node.js. So pretty standard stuff. The front end is in React.js and Redux. So pretty standard tools. Interoperable with GNU Social and OStatus platforms. And any platforms that use ActivityPub standard, which I never heard of, to be honest.
Well, so if you do want to go down the rabbit hole, ActivityPub is where you would go, because that is the message exchanging layer, and that is why Mastodon servers talk to each other. That is why Mastodon can talk to Diaspora. That is why Diaspora can talk to PeerTube, which is PeerTube is the open source YouTube, and that's why PeerTube can talk to PixelFed, which is the open source Instagram. They all speak ActivityPub. So in fact, even though you're living in a Mastodon world, which looks like Twitter, you can follow a PixelFed account, which is like Instagram. And the only thing you're going to get out of that feed, obviously, is pictures.
Right.
But as far as your server is concerned, it's just another post element. It doesn't matter what it is. So again, these are all interoperable. it's almost as if, you know, you could get different post type. You could get tweets in Facebook and vice versa, native in the newsfeed, which will never happen. Mm-hmm. But that's how ActivityPub's works. ActivityPub works in this universe.
And as you mentioned earlier, it's open source. And I'm, again, looking at the Wikipedia page, the source code is available on GitHub. So there you go. If you want to just take a look at the code yourself before you join, if you're really that geeky.
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is that it is positioned very frequently as the anti-Twitter, because Eugene, the lead developer, is decidedly anti-Nazi. So what will frequently happen is that people will basically accuse him of silencing dissent, of not being, I don't know, open and accepting of different ideas. You've probably heard of the free speech movement, which is unfortunately not the free speech movement I grew up with, but the we should let Nazis have their say because they're valid voices kind of free speech movement. The fact of the matter is, Eugene hates Nazis, but he cannot stop Nazis from using Mastodon. Mm. And there is, in fact, several Mastodon instances that are for, well, let's just say, independent thinkers outside the mainstream.
Yeah.
So the fact is, Eugene can't ban Nazis literally. He can ban Nazis from Mastodon.social, his instance, and I'm fairly confident in saying most instances probably ban Nazis, but the software itself is available to Nazis, just like email is available to Nazis, and you can't really blame email for existing if Nazis are using it.
Right.
You just probably don't want to interact with them. So yeah. there's a lot of big platforms for the right-wing, colorful wing of the universe, but most of the other instances don't federate with them, so they're just talking to themselves.
I see. So they're more of a what's the word they use in comic books? A pocket universe.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I noticed that looking at this list of servers again, at least the ones I'm looking at, and there are, in addition to the number of people on that instance, it also has a green dot that says it's stable. Does that mean that some instances are unstable? They're kind of up and down, or?
Yeah, I think that's basically what that means. Again, you have a lot of people who are tinkerers.
Yeah. Also just fussing around with the server.
Right. So they're basically saying, you can sign up for my server. I'm playing around. But if I decide I'm bored and don't pay any attention to it, then sorry. So, you know, that could be one reason you might not pick a unstable server.
I'm quiet because I'm listening, looking at all the different instances. Oh, there it is. Mastodon Technology. I see it. I finally scrolled down long enough.
Yeah, so if you sign up at Mastodon.technology and tell me that you're there, I'll follow you. You'll follow me, even though we're on completely different servers.
Hmm.
I'll see you at my newsfeed as if we were both on Twitter, but you're where you are and I'm where I am.
Hmm. And I haven't signed up yet, but I'm already seeing stuff in the right column of Mastodon.technology.
Yes.
I should know, that's the full URL, Mastodon.technology.
Yep.
With the, you know, domain of technology, which I didn't even know existed, but now I do. Okay, that scrolling feed is kind of interesting, although a lot of it is in, you know, I'm kind of the ugly American. I don't read any language except English. Well, German, passively.
So a couple of things there. What you're seeing on that column before you log in is what they call the federated timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So that is not just posts on Mastodon technology, that are posts that are coming into Mastodon technology.
Yeah.
Because other people on Mastodon.technology are following them. So if I were on Mastodon technology and I was following Will Wheaton on another server, Will Wheaton's posts would show up in that feed because they're coming in the front door anyway.
I see.
But that's how you see multiple languages that you don't speak. But when you're in Mastodon, you can basically say, just show me English, and then it'll be as if all those non-English posts don't even exist.
Hmm.
That must be very attractive to the outside of the box thinkers that we talked about earlier. Not to have to, you know, imagine any other language exists or culture exists.
That's right.
Now, wait, as it should be. I only want to see cats or whatever, you know. There are a lot of cats in this feed.
Well, there are a lot of cats in every feed, but I'd just like to point out there are a lot of cats on Twitter, too.
So. Yeah, that's true.
And Instagram.
Yeah,
that's true. Very, very true.
I mean, Mastodon does hashtags, and so just like you have the hashtag cats of Instagram hashtag, there's the Cats of Mastodon hashtag, and you can see cats across the Fediverse.
Yeah.
When I posted my first cat photo, it got the most likes of anything I ever posted on Mastodon.
Of course it would. Of course. It's a cat.
it's a cat.
It does do a little bit of that the fee just disappeared. But I noticed there are some things that says sensitive content. Click to view. So as it's scrolling down, it won't show everything. It'll give you a choice. It looks like
that's another thing that Mastodon does differently. In addition to having like 500 characters instead of 240 or 80, built into the architecture of Mastodon are content warnings, or CWs, otherwise known as spoiler alerts. So as you're typing a post and you want to post about Captain Marvel, you could actually click a little checkbox as you're posting, and it'll cover it up with a
prompt. So you as the end user or content creator choose to do that. It's not something they impose on you. Yeah. Well, that's nice. No. That's good.
Obviously, an instance will probably have a rule like we are totally cool with nudity, but you got to cover it up so that the only people who see it have to click to see it.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Okay, that's fair. So you're a person, not a product? Oh, I see. I'm kind of looking at the philosophy here.
Yeah, the philosophy of it, right.
Yeah.
So, for example, there are some brands on Mastodon, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation has an account, Proton Mail has an account. But for the most part, they discourage you signing up as a company, and they tell you to just be you.
That's very different, really, right? That's literally anti-Twitter, anti-Facebook, anti-whatever.
Right, but there's nothing stopping you either.
Right.
So you'll see a lot of companies in there.
They just sort of encourage you not to.
Yeah. The other thing that is very rampant on Mastodon, which will sound like a downside when I say it, is bots. But these are not Twitter bots that are designed to spread disinformation or clutter the newsfeed or spam you to death.
Mm-hmm.
People who are developing bot technology, which includes machine learning and AI and stuff like that, it is a platform that is friendly to entities that are automated. It can be as simple as every time I post a blog post, I want to post a link to it on Mastodon.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be something as complex as it can answer questions that you ask it the same way you can talk to your Alexa. Your cylinder from Amazon. But you can do those things because they are a class of entity on Mastodon. You, as the reader, can just click a box and say, don't show me any bots. And they just disappear. So there's weather bots and news bots and stuff like that. Some I like, so I have them in my feed. Some I don't. So.
Interesting. I'm just kind of still scrolling through the... Did it come to the end? No, I guess not.
Come to the end of the Mastodon universe, but...
Mastodon Cloud doesn't say what that is, though, but I can guess.
I think that's one of the more general instances.
Yeah.
I think the reason why you would join a larger instance is because when you join a smaller instance, it's just like joining Twitter on day two.
Yeah.
There's like six people there, and they're not talking very much.
Yeah.
When you join a big instance, there's a ton of crap happening. But the downside to that is there's a ton of crap happening.
Yeah.
So you gotta find that lucky, that perfect balance.
Yeah. There's a Mastodon.org, by the way, Mastodon instance for people of free open source and Linux. So.
Mastodon. Yeah.
Yeah. So lots of interesting stuff here, actually. There's one just for Chinese community hosts, I guess.
So. My instance, masthead.social, is currently closed, but any user on that instance can invite someone else.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you can generate a link that you can post publicly, and anyone who uses that link can get in. So it's not even like you can only invite two people.
Right.
You can invite 1,000 people if you give them your link.
Mm.
And the good thing about that link is that anyone who uses your link to sign up for an instance immediately becomes your follower. So... The upside of that is that usually when you join an instance cold, you get dropped into the main timeline. And you're like, who are these people? What are they talking about? I don't understand. I quit. Now, if you use a link, you're going to go in and, okay, sure, all they're going to see is Todd, 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 Todd. But at least they're like, I know who Todd is. I understand what's happening here. And, go from there.
What do you think the biggest community is? I'm kind of scrolling through and it seems like about 4,000.
No. There are instances in Japan that are massive, hundreds of thousands.
Oh, wow.
There's a problem, however. In Japan, there is a class of, shall we say, media that is perfectly acceptable in polite society, wherein the scenario is consenting adults pretending to be young children doing what consenting adults should do.
Oy.
But because of that, many, many Western instances do not federate with Japanese instances.
I can understand
so
why.
There's sort of this. So if you look at a data visualization of the Mastodon universe, there is a giant, giant circle over Japan, but that giant, giant circle is somewhat isolated.
Another pocket universe, more or less. Huh. All right. And some, I just don't know what it is, like a quilt. Is it quilt? I don't know. But, okay.
Where's your reading glasses, Todd? It looks like you're struggling a little there.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Any questions, John? I think I got all my questions in.
I think it's really interesting. I think the application to create your own little universe on a individual or family basis, I think, is a really cool idea.
Yeah.
Because it allows for that privacy that people want, but still the social aspect. And I could see if you're a large extended family or a large network of friends, you know, everyone who went to college at this particular place, and you know, some of their friends, you could have a pretty nice little network of people that all have some central similarities, some central connection. Yeah, it's kind of a cool idea.
Yeah, it'd be kind of neat for alumni groups and things, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, to close, let me tell you why I feel this is the future of social network.
Okay.
Because right now we're living in a world where Facebook is the great granddaddy of them all. 70% of all human beings have had some experience on Facebook.
True.
But it is. It is an organization controlled by a private company. It is an organization that is beholden to no one but shareholders. And organizations that are beholden to shareholders are only interested in making money. And right now, that seems like it's working fine. Capitalism is awesome, rah, rah, rah. But I don't think, in the long run, that you cannot say to anyone with a straight face that Facebook will be the platform that it is today 10 years from now, right? So the question is, what's the next one? And I don't think that after we learn all the ups and downs of a Facebook or a Twitter or an Instagram or a WhatsApp or these large platforms, that we're going to say the next thing is to join another thing just like this. That's just, I don't see that as happening either. In a universe that's federated the same way email is federated, where maybe 30% of the population is on Gmail, 20% of the population is on Hotmail, it's not exactly fully federated, but it's still broken up. I think that's what we're going to look at. And what I see attractive about Mastodon is what you just said. Why wouldn't the UH alumni organization run its own Mastodon instance? Why wouldn't CNN run its own Mastodon? Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't any large organization, IBM, run its own instance? Because you created a community, you control, you can moderate that community. It has an identity, it has loyalty built into the brand, and it can still interact with any other universe out there the same way email works.
Yeah.
So I think that that's where we're going to end up, that it's going to be like, oh, I'm in school, so I'm on my Mililani High School Mastodon instance, but I'm going to follow my dad over on his Apple instance. You know, I think that whether it's Mastodon or not, I don't know, but I think that model is what we're going to hopefully end up with after we've decided that putting all our eggs in one basket is not a good idea.
Yeah, I think Google Plus and a number of other social experiments tried that. You know, Google Plus tried to create the community idea, you know, where anybody could join a community, I think. Like, in fact, the only community left that I cared about is Google Plus shuts down, is right. The Google Fi community on Google Plus, because I actually found that useful. But
again, we all built our... When you build your community on someone else's plot of land, that plot of land can be yanked out from under you.
As it is right now. In fact, I think it just shut down. Yeah, didn't it shut down like on Thursday? I think so. Let me check.
I believe so. It was I think the 8th was supposed to be the date it shut down. So
I'm going to Google Plus. No, David Brin, you know, I'm a science fiction fan. David Brin just posted something 2 hours ago, so I guess Plus is still running, but notifications were turned off, I think. So I think that's gone. Yeah, I think notifications are gone. Yeah, no notification on. So if you go to Google Plus, no more notification icon. So the notifications were turned off on Thursday. I'm going to miss it. I actually like that feature.
No, that's another cautionary tale, and why federated social media is probably the way to go.
Yeah. All right, Ryan. Well, thanks for your time. Glad you were able to join us. I was really curious about it, since, you know, I'm always curious when you get real excited about stuff, and you seem really excited about this one. I've seen some of your posts in other places. I go, what is Ryan talking about? I need to ask.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
All righty. Okay, if you want to hang around, hang around. If you got to drop off, I know you're super busy. You know, drop off, but...
We're headed to Tyco Drive.
Oh, okay. That's funny. My wife and daughter do that, too.
Okay. Really? Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the only one who doesn't do it in this house, apparently. But
okay.
All right. Thank you, Ryan.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Okay.
Good talking to you, Ryan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I might try that out.
Yeah. Let me know. It might be interesting to... Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about some of the things where we've created groups in the past, or any of the private groups that you do on a large social media network. Be interesting to kind of pick the largest one and make it into Mastodon, in a sense.
Yeah.
So it's something to be thoughtful of, and definitely cool to know about and play around with.
Yeah. I mean, we have a bunch of friends where we have a private email list, and, you know, might be interesting. You know, of course, we've tried other things that didn't work, most of them Google. But
yeah. Well, that's because Google kept killing them. So, yeah. You know, it was kind of hard to keep them around.
Yeah. So email seems to work the best. Anyway.
Do you have any other questions about Disney technology? Since Ryan jumped on, you said you had other questions or that you were thinking about.
Yeah. So, well, it's not so much a technology thing, but the FastPass, the way that works now. I thought, and this was years ago, you know, obviously I haven't kept track on it. I thought if you were on a Disney property, as you will be, that you can get FastPass without going to the park itself. I mean, like right at the desk at the, you know.
That might have been possible staying on property. I never actually did during the years the FastPass was popular. But now you can, if you are staying on property, you can make FastPass plus selection 60 days out from when you're going.
Oh, okay.
Everyone else gets 30 days. So... basically, if you would like to lock in certain things, you can make up to 3 selections. And so I've already made my selections for the day. And then after you get there, once you've used your 3 selections, you can grab more fast passes off of the app. So stories of people saying, oh, well, you know, I'm at a line right now, and it's a 20-minute standby wait, but there's a fast pass also. I can just grab it and walk right into the fast pass line. You can do that if you're on the app. So, needless to say, I've also bought a large extended battery or anchor, you know, 3,000 or 30,000 milliamp hour battery to carry around in my pocket so that I can keep my phone fully charged the entire time I'm there.
You know, I'd be curious once you get there, you know, what the situation is in support of mobile devices these days. For example, do they have charging stations that you can, you know, kind of plop into for when you're, you know, grabbing a churro or something to eat and stand there and plug in. I'd be curious to see if that's a thing. I noticed that in some airports, you know, there's USB charging ports in various waiting areas. Heathrow, I remember, had that, and I think Portland maybe. And I think maybe even some bus and train stations, like Amtrak. Can't remember.
My worry is always, what are you plugging into?
Yeah, well, there is that. There's that.
There is a slight worry there. In fact, I do have somewhere a little USB, I forget where I got it, or it was a Kickstarter, that basically is a hardware bypass. So it cuts off the data pins and only leaves the power pins on USB so that you can put that at the end of your charging cable and know for sure nothing is trying to connect over data to your device.
You know, I've seen some cables listed as charging cables. Are those simply ones that don't have the data pins?
I assume so, that would be a way to prevent them from being able to be used for data, is just put them on the power pins.
Those would be kind of handy to have, actually. You know, you don't need any extra dongles. You just have to have, you know, a suitably colored cable that says, oh, this is the one I want to plug into, you know, potentially dangerous ports. Just power, no data. Yeah, because, in fact, I remember plugging my phone into a like an airline port, right, to charge it, and because I thought it was just a... I thought it was, you know, literally just for charging, but it, you know, it says, hey, do you want to allow, you know, it to access your data? I said, no.
No. Not really.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about this. This was a number of years ago, but definitely. Also kind of curious if I'm going to guess no, but if Disney provides, or I'm going to guess kind of yes, maybe, is where Disney provides Wi-Fi. Like, it probably won't provide it in the park itself. Let me rephrase that. In the walking slash ride areas. But I was thinking maybe they might provide it in the on-prem restaurants and things. But just curious. Things to... Since I haven't been there in years, you know, I don't know any of this stuff.
It is interesting. So I'm looking at Disney's website right now because I hadn't looked at that either.
Yeah.
But they do have Wi-Fi in the majority of the public spaces in the parks.
Huh. Well, yeah. I'm looking. They have a whole website for it.
Disney has gone kind of all in with BYOT, bring your own technology, in a sense.
Yeah.
They, which is interesting because they could very easily, I think Disney gets criticized very often for, you know, try to get your money any way possible. They could have very easily said, we're going to have a premium connected device that you could rent or you could buy one, you know, basically a little tablet or a phone or something like that, and the only way you're going to get access to all of our cool stuff like our Wi-Fi and FastPass and all that is if you buy this little device or rent this little device from us.
Yeah,
I could see that have been an option at some point, but imagine how annoying that would be from the consumer perspective. I assume that someone finally said, you know what, guys, that's not going to make us the money we think it's going to. Letting people have their own devices where they can share out their photos and all those things.
That's the thing, right? That's marketing for them.
Yeah. So I'm excited to see how this goes. And I'd like to provide updates.
Yeah. But I'd also like to for you to do a speed test. I'm kind of curious. It says here that it's in the theme parks, restaurants, and more, including Magic Kingdom, Epcot, Hollywood Studios, Animal Kingdom, blah, 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 blah. It's inside the resort hotels, including, it says may be available in bus loading zones, pool areas, arcades, and convention spaces, but it's complimentary Wi-Fi, so it's free. Comfort of your Disney room, hotel room. So that's pretty cool. And even in the park grounds.
I have also decided, you're going to find this interesting, that I am not going to take a point-and-shoot camera.
Oh.
I'm gonna use my iPhone 10 for pretty much everything.
Now, did you buy like one of those telephoto lens kits? I think you did.
I do have one, and I've thought about it, and I've thought about getting... Because the one I have has macro and a bunch of stuff that I don't really need. Right. All I really need is the long... telephoto.
Yeah.
So I may think about buying one of those if I can get something that I could just clip on easily onto my phone when I want to take a shot from a distance.
Yeah. Because I would say, and I haven't been to a Disney park with my daughter in many, many years, but I would say Disney is probably one of the places I would take a point and shoot with a good telephoto or zoom, I should say. Because sometimes, you know, you're just far away and you want to get a character photo from, you know, a distance, like during a performance or something, you know, like one of the many parades or those kind of things where you're not really up close as, you know, you might like for a nice photo. So actually it is one of those places when I travel for pleasure, I do tend to take a point and shoot. On business, not so much, you know, just kind of take my phone with me. Okay. Anyway, those are my questions. You know, basically not so much things you can answer now, but maybe once you get there, I'd like to hear more about the experience. You know, it used to be a hassle. I mean, you know, basically you had to take like a modem, and sometimes there wasn't even an RJ11 jack, and you'd have to take apart the phone, and it was just a...
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It's come a long way.
It really has, thankfully.
Yeah. Okay, so we've had a long podcast. Thanks to Ryan Rizal for stopping by and talking to us about Mastodon. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I want to say Mastodon, but I guess it's Mastodon the way it's spelled. I think I might lurk, see what's there, and maybe join up with some of the more interesting groups as I discover them. Okay, John, I think you're not available next weekend, or...
Yep, next weekend I'm traveling, but okay. I'll be back the weekend after.
Okay, so he will be on a super secret mission next weekend. Last time he was on a super secret mission, I just had a hot 1 week hiatus. We'll see what we do this time. We will talk to you later. Thank you, John. Thank you, Ryan Ozawa. Bye-bye.